This episode of the MedTalk podcast is brought to you by MedTech Innovation Expo, the UK and Ireland's leading event for medical device manufacturing. Save the date for MedTech Innovation Expo 2024, taking place on the 5th and 6th of June at the NEC in Birmingham. For more information, please visit www.medtechexpo.com.
Hello and welcome to the latest Talking Regs episode of the MedTalk podcast, where we have a conversation about the regulatory landscape in the medical device sector and get some expert thoughts on the current state of affairs. I'm Ian Bolland, your host and group content manager for MedTech Innovation and Medical Plastics News. And today I'm joined by Amy Russell, who's the Managing Director of Russell Regulatory Consultants. On this episode, we discuss Amy's journey to becoming a regulatory consultant, but also touch upon some of the key issues that she and medical device manufacturers are facing during a time of immense change. We also get Amy's thoughts on what she'd like to see change in the approvals process and what improvements can be made.
Amy, thank you very much for joining us on the MedTalk podcast. To start with, and this is how we approach all of our guests at the start, is to tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Yeah, hi Ian. So I'm the Managing Director of Russell Regulatory Consultants. So as the name suggests, it's a medical device regulatory consultancy company. So I've been in the industry since 2015, and probably quite unusual to hear is that I started off working for a notified body, not as an auditor, but as a something they called a technical coordinator. So that was really back office staff. So I was involved with reviewing change forms from manufacturers, reviewing vigilance notifications and managing class 3 device reviews. So during my time there, I probably saw the stuff that everybody wants to see. So I saw technical files, audit reports, was it responses, as well as all this kind of happening at a pivotal time of change in the industry. So the clinical evaluation MedDev revision 4 was released, as well as the MDR during that time. So it really was a kind of pivotal time. I then moved onto the other side of the fence, if you like, and worked as a regulatory specialist for a couple of companies in the cardiovascular and electrosurgical space before deciding it was time to go contracting. So as you can imagine, I came home one day and said to my parents, I'm going to start up a limited company and go freelancing. And my parents are all of the generation where they had one job their whole life, you know, they stayed in the same place. So when I came home and said that, they were pretty risk averse. So I didn't really like that idea. So it took a lot of convincing them to get on board with the idea. And then by chance, the first contract role that I had, the company actually went into administration 4 months into my contract. Disclaimer, through no fault of my own. So it wasn't the best start, but I've been very lucky since then to work with lots of different medical device companies and help them specifically on their MDR journey, I guess. And prior to working in the medtech industry, I initially thought that I wanted to save the world and cure diabetes. So I really thought academia was for me, but 4 years of working in a research lab during my PhD only made me realise that that kind of life wasn't for me.
What was it about that life that you didn't particularly like? Was it a case of, how could I put it? Was it a case of you could see what this does and that made you go to, the other side, shall we speak?
I think it was a few things. So, for example, some people's research projects really do show some exciting things, you know, and they show so much promise and, you know, you can see that their hypotheses, for example, are confirmed. And then they can go and carry on that story, and eventually it will lead to treatments being improved for whatever disease they're looking into. But my project, I just couldn't prove the hypotheses that my supervisor had drafted in the grant application. So it was just very demoralising, kind of going in and repeating experiments all the time and trying different things, then having to stand up in front of rooms full of professors who really, you know, they are there to get you, to be honest. So it was just very demoralising, and I think, you know, you work a lot of long hours, and I've never worked as hard as I worked during that time in the research lab. So yeah, it just wasn't for me. But during that time, you know, as a postgrad or even during my undergraduate studies, nobody ever told me about the medical device industry. And I would go to all of the careers fairs and everything that the universities held, and all I ever heard was pharmaceutical industry or research and kind of postdoc life. But I knew I wanted to stay roughly in health after my PhD. And growing up, I toyed with the idea of being a vet or going into law. So I guess I've kind of landed somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I was thinking as you were saying that, was that that time working in the more research part of it, is how has that informed, you know, where you've ended up?
Yeah, I mean, do you know what, it is really quite interesting, because obviously some of the skills are so transferable. So, you know, like, we had to write a thesis, we had to read a lot of literature and critically analyse it, and it's only now that it kind of comes to fruition when I'm writing clinical evaluation reports that you see the true added benefit of sticking with the PhD, even though I hated it at times.
Yeah, I mean, I only went as far as a master's, so I'd never dream of what a PhD would be like.
Yeah, soul destroying. Some people love it, it just wasn't for me.
That's fair enough. I want to come on to the time when you founded your business, Russell Regulatory. I wonder who that's named after. It seemed to be around a time where it was really ever-changing legislation, because there was the implementation, well, the start of MDR, IVDR, the UK leaving, the European Union is now embarking on its own regulatory path. You couldn't have really timed it better, really, in terms of people coming to you asking, so what do I do now? Was that deliberate, or was it just pure coincidence?
I guess you could say that part was probably quite deliberate. So how it happened was that my last permanent role was for quite a large corporation where there seemed to be contractors working full time in every department. And then when MDR, kind of the project came around for MDR, the regs team hired 3 MDR consultants, and I basically thought, well, I'm on the MDR project with them, but I'm also doing registrations and all this other day-to-day reg stuff. So why not? And I think some of the misconceptions I had at the time, and probably people have now, is that contractors, consultants have to be experts in everything, which isn't true. Mostly you have to know what you're claiming to know. But also at that time, you know, that was probably 2018, so nobody had experience with MDR, so we were all winging it to an extent. I just put my wings on too.
That's a lovely phrase. I'm going to use that one in the future. But I think you've sort of touched upon this, but we'll continue with the theme around MDR and the like, because I'm fascinated to know what the main challenges that you see as a regulatory consultant now, because, I mean, Are they the same kind of challenges that people are coming to you with, or do you see it from a different perspective?
In terms of like clients coming to me,
yeah,
with issues, do you know, it's funny because we've known about MDR for a long time, but even now, I mean, this is 7 years later, I still find there's clients that haven't really planned accordingly, and it shouldn't be this way at all. But even some of the larger corporations where, you know, you would anticipate that they would be really organised, there's still things that they haven't done that surprised me. just from an organizational perspective, you know, even like step one for MDR for me was always look at your product portfolio, and if things aren't selling, could you rationalize those products? Because MDR is expensive, and the effort to transfer those files from MDD to MDR is going to take time and resource. So if you're not selling a certain product as much, maybe think about rationalizing it. But lots of companies didn't do that, and now they're in a bit of a hole. And that's before you even start kind of doing the gap analyses and writing the tech docs and updating clinical evaluations. So yeah, I think there's still issues that I saw back in 2017 that I'm still facing now with some clients, which is scary, but hopefully that'll change.
Interesting point that you raised at the top of your answer there, because I hear about people talking about complexities, there's more to MDR and the like, but I've never heard anyone use the word, it's more expensive. Is that all linked to the fact that it just takes more energy and there's more time and resource to go through things to make sure you're compliant?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think, you know, if you're a manufacturer and you have to invest in the whole resource team, you know, so, you know, engineers and regulatory professionals and people that have the expert knowledge there, you know, you're at least going to have to invest in training for MDR. So that alone is a cost. And then actually applying the training to your devices and to what you're doing probably takes more training. And then, you know, audits are a killer for some companies, especially, you know, the smaller ones who don't have large budgets. And it seems, you know, notified bodies are just getting more and more expensive.
There's also the bit about capacity, and I imagine you've got a few thoughts on notified body capacity as well, because I've never spoken to anyone in the consultancy space that hasn't got a thought about capacity. I'm gonna hazard a guess that you think there needs to be more capacity.
How would you guess that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually quite sad, because I think, you know, obviously I worked for a notified body, that was my very first role, so at that time, there was a lot of talks about resource and, you know, even getting auditors and people in the back office at the notified body. But I think it actually goes further than that. I think, like, there are gaps everywhere in the chain. So I think there's a gap at the kind of commission, you know, regulation level. Then there's notified bodies, auditors, and then there's the big professionals themselves. And actually getting that specialist knowledge, I think, is becoming quite difficult. And that's why I always advocate that if you're in the medtech industry, you should be telling people what you do. As an example, my brother told me last week he thinks I work in patents, even though I've described it 100 times. But we should really be talking to everyone about what we do, and especially, you know, young people, because, you know, decades from now, there's going to be an even further resource gap. And, you know, what's going to happen is that there'll just be a supply issue of medical devices if we don't sort it out ultimately.
From what you've said, and I mean, notified body capacity aside, it'd probably be better for you and for the wider industry if there was more of a notified body capacity. But even though people would suggest that going through all the red tape, the regs, directives, and they'll probably all say it's a little less glamorous side of the industry. But obviously, it's one that you love. But is there a better time to be in it, in your opinion? Because there's so much changing.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I would probably disagree with that, because in my experience, you know, what I've done over my career is, you know, the focus has been on the legacy devices, which are maybe not less glamorous, but maybe more run-of-the-mill documents already exist to support. They just need kind of tweaking. Whereas with developing technology, you're writing regulatory strategies for new devices, you're adding value to the early kind of design documents. So as you can imagine, over the last 7 years, most of the MDR work has been on those legacy devices with little room and budgets to invest in new product development. So it's always quite exciting when someone approaches us with a new device to work on. So I think it's a great time to be in the industry.
Okay, so we're going to move on to the AI aspect now, because AI is becoming more and more prevalent. I think we've even seen AI tools being used to try and do documentation as well. But let's focus on AI itself as the technology and how it's more prominent within medical devices, but also the wider industry. Do you think the industry is prepared for its effects, or it's adapted to what effect it's having now?
No.
Sweet answer.
Next. No, I think obviously, you know, the use of machines to do complex tasks that we would associate with human intelligence is one of the most exciting areas of the medtech industry, and definitely one of the buzzwords that I keep hearing time after time after time. And it's because of the potential benefits. So, you know, we could get faster diagnoses, prediction of pandemics, clinical decision support, and digital therapeutics. And that aspiration is that, you know, those decisions will be free of human error, free of inconsistencies, and scalable, which is particularly attractive to healthcare systems across the globe just now that are severely stretched. But the concern is that we don't yet know how to ensure the effectiveness of these technologies, or how best to detect, analyse, report, act upon the errors or the harms. And most of these technologies are piloted, and when they go out at scale, you know, maybe in like national screening programmes, a failure to detect or mitigate against potential errors could have repercussions at a population level. So I think there's an urgent need, and it's a very delicate balance between not hampering innovation, but not causing any issues with respect to patient safety. And I think, you know, as the technology advances, we're trying to keep up with that in terms of the regulations matching it. It'll be a very interesting space. It develops every week at the moment, so I think watch this space.
With that in mind then, what do you make of the EU's AI Act that's been drafted?
Yeah, do you know what? I do think it paves a way, it paves the kind of initial path, but I think it's like any kind of initial regulation. I think there'll be lots of guidance, there'll be lots of updates as technology changes and we start to use it. I think sometimes using the regulation and using these kind of guidances produces more questions in time. So yeah, I think watch how it may change in future.
I mean, it feels like it's the nature of anything that's new or dealing with something new, is that the hardest point is can't be the starting point and getting things in motion and then seeing how it works. And there's always a lot of trial and error associated with it. I think what you've actually said in your answer was to the AI question itself, is that not entirely sure that people are prepared for the error, but they think it's a silver bullet.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So I would like to want to, if you actually had your way, you were in charge of regulation. I know it's that's a big question in itself, but is there anything that you've actually seen in the regulations or in particular environments that you think you would like to see change? So what would make life easier for consultants like yourselves or engineers? And has anything happened lately that has made things more difficult? We've probably covered one or two aspects, I don't know.
Yeah, I think in an ideal world, which we're not in, but in an ideal world, we would have harmonisation with respect to regulatory market access. So, for example, we've got MDSAP, which means that a manufacturer can have one audit and sell into five different countries. But I think there's definitely a long way to go, and it can be very frustrating for a medical device manufacturer, as well as the engineers and consultants involved, having to prepare different documents that essentially say the same thing, but not quite. So I get a lot of clients come to me, especially for kind of just launching their first medical device, and they just don't get it. And it's very difficult to describe to them why they need a technical document for the EU. They need a technical file for the UK. They need maybe a 510K for America. And then they need to adapt their QMS processes to reference the correct clauses. And they have vigilance reporting requirements that are all different You know, so I think centralisation of regulations is not realistic, but I feel that by making it more complex, manufacturers do one of two things, and they either sell to lots of different regions, but then ultimately can't keep up with the changing regulatory landscapes, and then end up with a recall or something similar, or they just choose not to sell into those regions at all, which then causes issues with supply. One other area that's probably more realistic that I would like to see change is that, as I've spoken about earlier, there's lots of costs associated with audits, and I would love to see more investment specifically for regulatory for startups and SMEs, just to support them on that kind of audit journey.
Where would that investment come from, as you envisage it? I mean, I'm sorry, I know I'm probably going down the realms of giving you a political interview here, so I promise you this is my only one question about policy towards you.
To be honest, I don't know. It's not particularly my field. I don't know if it would come from government or kind of private investors or where it would come from, but I think it's just something that's often overlooked. I think startups especially get very wrapped up in getting investment to develop the product. But when it comes to regulatory, they don't really consider what the initial audit costs can be, and then they can get themselves into some trouble. So just something to consider.
Well, if any politicians are listening to this, it is an election year. So Amy's given you an idea. You find a solution. and we'll see if she votes for it. So I'm just going to cover to the final part now. Before I ask if you'd like to add anything else, I want you to get your crystal ball out. Yeah, it's a great image for all those listening, I'm sure. But how do you think that the regulatory environment in medical devices, be that in the UK, Europe, the United States, how do you think that's going to look in, say, 5 years' time? Are we still going to be going through these turbulent patches that we've seen of late, or do you think that things might settle down a bit and manufacturers, consultants will have a clearer picture about what they're dealing with?
Well, I mean, I'm not Mystic Meg, but if I was, I don't actually think, well, maybe I sound really pessimistic here, but I don't think things will settle down, because it's at the moment we're very reactive to the technology that's coming through, and the regulation, you know, needs a lot of work to work for those kind of products. And I think, you know, over the next 5 years, we'll see more AI devices, you know, a higher proportion of all CE mark devices will be AI, digital healthcare. There'll be more focus on cybersecurity and how to handle data breaches and things like that. But it will be interesting to see how those advances in technology impact the regulation and if the regulations can keep up worldwide.
That's fascinating. I've heard that a couple of times now. See if the regulations can keep up worldwide. It feels like that any time that a regulatory pathway is set out or new regulations are brought in, it feels like you need to have engineers and those close to technology at the heart of it, consult them first before you go off on any tangents just because you're a lawmaker. So we're coming to the end now. Thank you very much for agreeing to take part. And I always ask this question to our guests. Anything else that you'd like to add at all? What are your final thoughts you'd like to give to our listeners?
Maybe just a shameless plug for Russell Regulatory Consulting.
That is very shameless.
And that's me. So yeah, if you're looking for any regulatory support, just contact me on LinkedIn or visit our website.
I can guarantee everybody that Amy's LinkedIn game is very, very good, by the way. So I should give her a big compliment for that. Amy, thanks very much for joining us.
Problem. Thanks very much.